Thank you very much. First, I want to say a couple of things. I'm not actually in charge of model validation at the Fed. The person who is would be annoyed if he found out that I was saying that I was. So I am a researcher at the Fed, and I'm only speaking for myself, not for the rest of the Fed. In fact, I can tell you that the person who is in charge of model validation at the Fed would probably disagree with some of the things I'm about to say. So I do want to say that the usual caveat applies. I'm a researcher, and I'm speaking for Eric Heitfield, not for the Board of Governors or its staff. The objective of this research project was to understand how rating system dynamics might affect regulatory capital requirements and also the validation of key inputs into the Basel II risk weight function. This is an area which has recently become an area of research interest for folks working in Basel as we started to think about actually finally getting the accord signed and trying to think about how we might actually validate the inputs that banks are going to be required to report to us. So I plan to explore this issue of the interaction between bank rating philosophy and PD validation in two ways. The first is to develop a very stylized model of rating system dynamics. And as you'll see, when I say stylized, I mean very stylized. The purpose of this model is not to provide an accurate description of what default probabilities look like or how banks rate obligors, but rather to provide a characterization of that process, a very simple characterization, which will allow us to get some easy closed-form analytical solutions that will help us understand the relationship between a bank's rating philosophy and PD quantification. And the second way I plan to explore this issue is to illustrate some of the results of the model using a very simple simulation based on KMV and S&P data. So the talk is going to be structured as follows. First, I just want to briefly show you a few slides about Basel II, what is it, and what is sort of the topic that we're talking about today. I want to then talk about what I mean when I'm talking about a default probability. One of the themes that I think is going to come out of this talk is that we get into trouble if we're not very clear about what we mean when we talk about these risk parameters that we're asking banks to report under Basel II. And so I'm going to spend a little bit of time defining this concept of a default probability in some detail. Then I'm going to talk about two sort of canonical approaches to rating obligors. One would be a point-in-time type of approach, and the other is a through-the-cycle approach. And I'll show how you can characterize those two approaches using a very simple model. Next, I'll talk about how Basel II proposes that banks quantify PDs. And as you'll see, it's not exactly the way you might expect. Finally, in addition, the next topic will be a discussion of the impact of the Basel II quantification process on the dynamics of banks' risk-based capital. And here what we'll see is the details of the way that Basel proposes the banks quantify PDs will imply a role for rating philosophy in the management of capital. And in particular, what it'll mean is that through the cycle rating systems imply different capital requirements from point-in-time rating systems. Next, I'll talk about the implications of the Basel quantification process for the validation of bank-reported PDs. And here I'm focusing, since I'm sort of a quant type, I'm focusing only on sort of empirical validation techniques. So I'm not talking about going in and having conversations with the risk managers and making sure that there's accountability and separation of risk management function from loan approval function and things like that. Here I'm talking only about kind of statistical tools that one might use for validation. And I'll talk about sort of two approaches that regulators have thrown around for validating bank-reported PDs. Benchmarking, that is, comparing PDs for similar obligors across banks, and back testing, that is, comparing the reported PD that a bank gives you with historical default data. And finally, I'll summarize the talk and draw some conclusions. So Basel II, what is it? Well, Basel II is the second version of the Basel Capital Accord, and its objective is to try to more closely align regulatory capital requirements with the underlying risks faced by banks. Now, Basel II actually has separate components for operational risk and credit risk. I'm going to focus tonight only on the credit risk side. The work on Basel II started in 1999. We thought we'd be done by 2001, and that didn't quite happen. The most recent important document released by the Basel Committee was the third consultative package that was released in June of last year. And the purpose of that package was to elicit comment from industry. That package basically described a prototype for the accord. It had sort of prototype language in it, and we asked industry to give us our comments on that package. Over the last year, the Basel Committee has been reviewing those comments, and in addition, reviewing the results of its third quantitative impact study. Trying to recalibrate the accord to sort of reflect industry comment and the quantitative impact study. And hopefully, God willing, a final accord will be signed in June of this year, although I'm not actually allowed to call it a final accord. We're now calling it a framework because there's some question about what we mean when we talk about accord. But for all intents and purposes, we hope that the development phase of Basel will end in June 2004. Some additional holes to fill after that, but the broad accord should be done by June of this year, and then the accord will be implemented going forward starting in 2007. I'm going to focus tonight on the most advanced version of the Basel Accord called the internal ratings-based approach, and this approach basically tries to reconcile two competing goals. Okay. On one hand, banks and risk managers have told us that they want to be able to leverage their internal capital, economic capital systems to the greatest extent possible for the purpose of calculating regulatory capital. And of course, in the limit, that would be a full internal models approach where supervisors validate banks' models and then they use their internal models to calculate regulatory capital requirement. That's one goal. The other objective is supervisors' concerns about how well developed these models are and also about their ability to effectively validate these models and to ensure that capital standards are applied in a fair and consistent manner across banks. In some sense, these two competing goals are at odds with one another. And so the version of the Basel Accord that's likely to be signed in June is going to reflect a kind of compromise between these goals. On one hand, banks are going to be allowed to use their internal data systems, and they're going to be allowed to use some of their own internal processes for calculating key risk parameters. However, at the end of the day, those risk parameters are going to be plugged into a regulatory risk weight function, which will then be used to calculate regulatory capital. So it's sort of a halfway solution. Banks can provide some of the inputs into the capital model, but they can't provide the capital model itself. And the key inputs that banks are going to be required, that advanced banks are going to be required to provide regulators for each exposure, they're going to have to tell us what that exposure's probability of default is, what its loss given default is, what its maturity is, and what its exposure at default is. And we're going to take those four parameters, plug them into a simple risk weight function, which is described in CP3, and use that to calculate regulatory capital. Now tonight, I'm going to focus on the quantification and validation of just one of these four parameters, the probability of default. So what is a probability of default? Well, to my mind, a probability of default is simply a type of forecast. It's a forecast of a very specific event, that is, it is a forecast of the likelihood that an obligor will default over a fixed time horizon, and for Basel II, we use a one-year time horizon. Now, like all forecasts, this one depends on data. And you can sort of break the information that banks have available into sort of two types of data, obligor-specific data and macroeconomic or aggregate data. So you might have information on an obligor's balance sheet ratios, its revenues, its line of business, its management quality. You might also have information on the business condition under which that obligor operates, things like the unemployment rate, the GDP growth rate, some index of sales for its industry, things like that. Now, generally, these are going to be overlapping information sets. They're not going to be uncorrelated with one another. For example, during economic downturns, you know, you're going to have macroeconomic indicators that tell you that you're in a recession. At the same time, it's likely that an obligor's balance sheet ratios are going to get worse. So in some sense, a bank faces a choice about how much to focus on obligor-specific information versus aggregate information. For modeling purposes tonight, I'm going to say let's define the obligor-specific information as everything which could not be explained by macroeconomic variables. So one way of thinking about it is, suppose I took the obligor-specific characteristics and ran a regression with them on the left-hand side and macroeconomic variables on the right-hand side. Then the obligor-specific information is really the residual. Okay, so we're sort of taking everything that can be aggregated and incorporating that into aggregate information. An unstressed PD, this is my own terminology. You could also, I used to call it an unconditional PD or an unbiased PD, various people objected to that terminology. So now I'm calling it an unstressed PD, is what I think of as, you know, sort of your best guess of the likelihood that an obligor will default over the one-year time horizon. Okay. So this is an efficient, unbiased estimator of the likelihood of default, and it should use all available, observable information. A stress PD, we can think of as a conditional forecast. It's a prediction of the likelihood of default assuming an adverse macroeconomic scenario. Okay? Another way of thinking about it is it's a pessimistic forecast. And because it relies on an economic scenario, presumably a pessimistic economic scenario, rather than economic data, it's going to tend to place less weight than an unstressed PD on observable aggregate information. So I can characterize these two types of PDs with a very stylized model. So this is a very simple Merton style distance to default model. You have an obligor whose default is driven by an underlying unobservable factor Z, and the idea is the obligor defaults if Z falls below zero. So this should be very standard. I'm going to assume that Z at time t plus 1 is driven by four risk factors. W is a variable that simply describes that information about the obligor that doesn't change over time. X describes, again, the residual information about the obligor that's uncorrelated with the business cycle that's observable. Y is going to be a key variable in this analysis. It's a proxy for the current business conditions, the current observable business conditions. So the way I think about Y is if it's positive, we're in a business cycle expansion. If it's negative, we're in a recession. And finally, U is something which is not observable at date T that determines whether or not the obligor will default at date T plus 1. So W, X, and Y are all observable variables. They can be used for forecasting. They can be used for rating an obligor. But U is information which cannot be observed by the bank at the date at which the rating is assigned. And U itself has two components, a systematic component and an idiosyncratic component. Okay? So this is the shock to the economy that you couldn't observe at date T. This is everything that's specific to the obligor. And the parameters here are just parameters. They're assumed known by the bank, and they just sort of capture the sensitivity to each of these risk factors. So in the simple model, I can easily characterize an unconditional default probability. It's simply the probability that Z falls below zero on date T plus 1, conditional on everything you observe. Okay, and you can simply write out that probability. I've assumed everything's standard, normal, and independent, so you get lots of nice closed-form solutions for everything. And this is the obligor's default probability, conditional on the observable information at time t. And what's nice about this equation is it sort of makes sense. And you can sort of look at it and sort of see comparative statics. For instance, when we get good draws of the macroeconomy, there's a negative sign in front here, so the default probability is going to go down. When you get bad draws of the economy, when Y is negative, the default probability is going to go up. And similar with the other risk factors. Very simple characterization. We can also characterize a so-called stress PD or stress scenario PD. Okay, but first we have to define a stress scenario. Now, I assume, and you can think about this in different ways, but for the purpose of this model, I'm going to assume that when we define the stress scenario, we're talking about the scenario at time t that we expect to evolve over the course of time t plus 1. And that's going to be a sum of assumptions about two factors, the observable state of the economy and the idiosyncratic factor as well. And we're going to assume, we're going to make a forecast conditional on the assumption that the sum of those two variables, okay, sums to some parameter, which is a bad state of the world. So the larger is this parameter, the more pessimistic is our stress scenario. Now, what's important about this particular characterization of the stress scenario is, note that it sort of balances out any good news we have. So if we're in a really good state of the economy today, then this stress scenario has to assume a very bad draw of the systematic risk factor in order to get us to the stress scenario. Well, if you define stress scenarios in this way, then it's easy to calculate an unconditional default probability. Again, it's just the probability conditional on what we observe, as well as the stress scenario. And here's the unconditional default probability here. The critical thing to understand about this, this should be stress PD. The critical thing to observe about the stress PD is that it does not depend on where we are in the business cycle. In a sense, you're replacing the current information, Y, about the business cycle with a stress scenario. So in the very extreme case of the stylized model, you're essentially taking out all information about where we are in the business cycle. And your forecast only reflects observable information about the obligor that's uncorrelated with the business cycle and our stress scenario assumption. Now, with this simple model in hand, we're ready to start talking about rating systems. The way I define a rating system is it's a way for the bank to assign a grade to obligors that reflects that obligor's underlying credit quality. And for modeling purposes, I'm going to assume that the rating system actually reflects one of these two types of PDs associated with the obligor. Now, in fact, bank rating systems can differ from one another in a number of different ways. For example, they can differ in terms of granularity, the number of grades. Some banks use 7 grades. Some grades use 21 grades. And some banks, for some retail portfolios, use a continuous credit scoring type rating system. They can also differ in terms of the time horizon over which ratings are assigned. Some ratings focus on a 1-year time horizon for assessing obligors. Some use a 3-year time horizon. Many actually tell us that they rate loans according to the duration of that loan. So they use a different time horizon for assessing different exposures. I'm going to talk about a very specific way in which rating systems can differ from one another. For the purpose of this model, I'm going to assume that it's a continuous rating system. That just makes the math a lot easier. I'm going to assume that the time horizon is 1 year, but I'm going to consider differences in rating philosophy. Now, when banks talk about their rating systems, or when practitioners talk about rating systems, you can kind of characterize them in terms of two canonical rating philosophies, a point-in-time rating philosophy and a through-the-cycle rating philosophy. In fact, in the real world, there's probably very few rating systems short of one based, you know, really squarely on something like KMV. There are probably very few rating systems that really characterize one of these two extremes. Most of them reflect a hybrid type system. Now, what do we mean by point-in-time and through-the-cycle? Well, unfortunately, no one really knows. Different people use those terms differently. So I'm going to use a definition that I pulled out of a Basel Committee report. And basically, I think this definition sort of characterizes well the way people commonly think about the distinction between point in time and through the cycle rating system. A point in time rating system focuses on current conditions. Okay? It uses the available information about an obligor to assign a rating that reflects information about that obligor that is likely to change over the business cycle. And as a result, point-in-time ratings will tend to be correlated with the business cycle. A through-the-cycle rating system doesn't necessarily have to have a longer time horizon, but it does take a longer-term view in terms of what it takes to change a rating. through the cycle, rating systems are designed in part to ensure that ratings don't change over the business cycle. One way of thinking about it is, are you grading on an absolute scale or are you grading on a curve? I think of through the cycle, you sort of grading on a curve. When times get worse, ratings don't necessarily get worse. For modeling purposes, you can think of a point in time rating system as being tied to a firm's unconditional default probability, and a through the cycle rating system as being tied to a bank's to a firm's stressed default probability. And that's exactly what I'm going to do in my model. Okay. So again, the point in time rating system, point in time is going to assign grades to an obligor that reflect its underlying unstressed PD. That unstressed PD tends to vary over the business cycle, and as a result, the rating is going to vary over the business cycle. Through the cycle rating system focuses on a firm's stressed PD, which, as I just showed you, doesn't vary over the business cycle, and the result, the rating assigned to a firm will tend not to vary over the business cycle either. So to characterize the point-in-time rating system in the context of this model is very easy. Remember, we've assumed a continuous rating system. So essentially what we're saying is the rating process is a function which maps observable information about the obligor to a score, gamma. And this is the right function to use if you want to ensure that all obligors who have the same rating get the same unstressed PD. Now, what's nice about this characterization is that you can actually define an unstressed PD not just for an obligor, but for a particular rating grade. So I can now talk about the likelihood of default of an individual obligor. I can also talk about how an obligor's grade maps into a likelihood of default. Through the cycle rating system is defined in much the same way. Again, the bank is going to look at observable information about the obligor. However, this time it's going to ignore information about the state of the macroeconomy. So it's going to ignore that Y term, and you get a stress, and in that case, all obligors in the same grade are going to share the same stress default probability. Note that this doesn't vary with the business cycle or with any other variable. It's all parameters. So by construction, the point-in-time rating system is defined in such a way that all obligors assigned a particular grade will have a particular unstressed PD. So the unstressed PD associated with the rating grade does not change over the business cycle. Importantly, that is not true for the unstressed PD associated with a through-the-cycle rating system. Although the through-the-cycle rating system is designed so that all obligors in a grade share the same stressed PD, okay, it's not the case that all obligors in a through-the-cycle rating system will share the same unstressed PD. And in fact, the unstressed default probability associated with a particular through-the-cycle grade will be negatively related to the business cycle. During good times, the PDs associated with through-the-cycle grades will go down. During bad times, the unstressed PDs associated with through-the-cycle ratings will go up. So let me illustrate this using a very simple historical simulation exercise. So this is very rudimentary. What I did was I took data on obligors who had both S&P and KMV ratings. Now, I make no claims that this is in any way reflective of the bank's actual portfolio, or that there's no issues about correcting for sample selection. I'm only trying to use this to illustrate differences across rating systems, not to sort of quantify the magnitude of the effect on any particular bank. I have monthly observations going back for the 5 years preceding January 2004. And I'm going to make some assumptions for the purpose of these simulations. I'm going to assume that KMV got it right, that the KMV EDF assigned to each of these obligors truly reflects its unconditional default probability, that is, the best available forecast of the likelihood that that obligor will default over the next 365 days. I will then use those CANV EDFs to construct a very rudimentary point-in-time grading system. So all I'm going to do is define thresholds. I'm going to define a set of thresholds, and the point-in-time grade you're assigned depends on where your CANV EDF, that is your unstressed PD, lies. To simulate it through the FICO rating system, I'm just going to use the S&P grades. S&P actually sends a lot of mixed signals about how it is they grade things, but I think broadly you could characterize S&P's approach to grading things as being through the cycle. Certainly, they don't like to downgrade someone and then upgrade them 6 months later, and they've sort of designed their rating process to ensure that that doesn't happen. So what this simulation does is this just sort of shows you what the distribution of obligors is by point-in-time ratings over time. So basically, each month is a bar graph here that sums up to 100%. And at the top, unfortunately, just sort of the way MATLAB worked, the top part is the worst grade, and the bottom part is the best grade. And so what you see here is a lot of transitions over the business cycle. What you see for this simple point-in-time rating system is that as we go into the 2000-2001 recession, the share of obligors in the highest grades gets lower, and the share of obligors in the lowest grades gets higher. Okay? So these point-in-time rating systems are getting worse at the trough of the business cycle, and then things transition in the other direction as we start coming out of the recession, and rating grades start to get better. The next slide I'm going to show you takes for each of these buckets, for each of these rating grades, it simply calculates the average PD, the average unstressed PD, that is the average CANV EDF for each grade. And this actually isn't very surprising. What you get is remarkable stability in these PDs. Now, this is not, you know, a deep analytical result. This is by construction. Remember, the way we defined this rating system was we defined buckets of PDs. So when your PD changes, your grade changes. And so as a result, the average PD associated with each grade tends to stay the same over the business cycle. In fact, if we had an infinite number of obligors, these would be straight lines going across. You do get straight lines at the top and bottom. That's just an artifact of the fact that CANV imposes caps and floors on the PDs it reports. The point to take away from the slide, though, is that the unstressed PDs, the average EDFs, the average unstressed PDs associated with each of these point-in-time rating systems, rating grades, is stable over time. However, the ratings themselves, the distribution of ratings, is not stable over the business cycle. Now, contrast that with what happens in the S&P grades, our kind of example of a through-the-cycle rating system. Now here, what you have is that essentially ratings are trending downward. I don't know why that is. Maybe S&P is rating more bad quality obligors than they used to, or maybe they've just sort of slowly raised their rating standards. I can't really say. But the big point to take away from this is, while there is a secular trend, there's no cyclical trend. There's no sense in which you see ratings getting worse during the trough of the business cycle and then better as we come out of the trough. On the other hand, look at the exercise where we simply calculate the average PD associated with each grade over time. Here you see much greater volatility in the EDFs, the average EDFs within each S&P grade. And again, that's not surprising. The S&P grades are themselves stable over time. We know these PDs are moving over time, so something's got to shift. And what shifts in this case, because the rating is relatively stable, is that you have the PDs going up during recessions and down as we come out of the recessions. Again, this, I think, might reflect some broadening of the number of obligors. This last one, I think, reflects a change in the set of obligors that are being rated. Okay, so I've sort of described a simple model of obligor default, very rudimentary. I've described a very stylized model of rating systems, and I've made some points about how PDs, unstressed PDs associated with point-in-time ratings tend to be stable over the business cycle, and unstressed PDs associated with through-the-cycle ratings tend to be volatile over the business cycle. It turns out that Basel II doesn't actually ask for either unstressed or stressed PDs. It asks for something that is in many ways totally different from either. What it asks for is something called a pooled PD. Okay? How do pooled PDs work? Well, if you go to CP3, what you'll find is that a bank that wants to be Basel II compliant has to report PDs based on a sort of two-stage process. In the first stage, it assigns obligors to grades. Okay? So this is the internal ratings-based part of the IRB system. It has to assign obligors to its own internal rating grades, and it has to have lots of systems in place to ensure that its rating process is genuine. Then, the bank estimates a pooled PD for each grade, and then every obligor within a grade is assigned that pooled PD. Okay? When I think of a PD, I think of it as a forecast associated with an individual obligor. It's a forecast that that obligor will default. But that's not what Basel II tells banks to do. Basel II introduces this intermediate step in between the obligors and the PDs to which they're assigned that we call the rating system. Okay? It says first you assign an obligor a grade, then you assign a PD to that grade, and then all the obligors within that grade get the same pooled PD. And as we'll see in a minute, putting the rating system in the middle of this diagram sometimes has implications for what those PDs look like. Basel II actually tells banks how they should calculate the pooled PD associated with each grade. Paragraph 409 of CP3 tells the bank that the pooled PD for a grade should be the long-run average of one-year observed default rates for borrowers in that grade. Very specific, very prescriptive language on what a PD should represent. I think the reason it's so prescriptive here is because supervisors were very concerned about validation, so they wanted to have, you know, language that a bank could follow to the letter. But as we'll see, this might be a case where Basel could have been a little too prescriptive. Now, what this language means and the previous slide means is that the PD assigned to an obligor depends on the grade to which it's assigned, but it doesn't depend directly on the characteristics of the obligor. To show you why, we've got to model what these pooled PDs look like. Now, Basel said it should be the average of the long-run observed default frequency. If you took that average over all years, over all states of the world, what that would be is the expected default frequency for the grade without conditioning on Y, without conditioning on the observed state of the business cycle, because you're sort of averaging over across all dates. And that's the variable I'm going to look at, because that's what we can get a closed-form solution to. And what it allows us to do is abstract from issues of estimation. So I'm not really focused on whether the bank can adequately estimate these pooled PDs. I'm assuming that it knows the model and it can get a true pooled PD, and then we'll look at the characteristics of those. So in some sense, this model is actually easier than the real world, where you not only have to worry about whether the bank is reporting the correct not only have to worry about the mechanism that Basel sets up for what the PD is supposed to be, you also have to worry about estimation issues. I'm sort of abstracting from estimation issues. So we can actually, what's nice about abstracting from estimation issues is you can now calculate the pooled PD associated with a grade. So here's the pooled PD for a point-in-time system. Okay, D is an indicator variable, 0 if you don't default, 1 if you do. The pooled PD is simply the expectation of that variable that doesn't condition on Y. It does condition on your grade, so to the extent that your grade depends on Y, the observed state of the economy matters, but you don't separately treat Y here. So you can do the calculation, and of course, not surprisingly, the pooled PD for a point-in-time rating system in a continuous rating system is exactly equal to the unstressed PD associated with each of the obligors assigned to that system, right? The unstressed PD assigned to that grade. The unstressed PD, remember, is the unbiased forecast of the likelihood that obligor will default. So over time, that is actually going to be the default probability associated with that grade. May not be the default probability in any particular year because of the presence of systematic risk, but over time that systematic risk averages out, and so the pooled PD associated with the point-in-time rating system is exactly equal to the unstressed PD associated with that grade. Now you can also take the next step, right? What Basel II says is that once you've assigned a pooled PD to a grade, you now assign that to each individual obligor. To do that in the context of the model, you simply take this function that you got from the grade and you plug it in and you write the pooled PD, which again, the pooled PD associated with an obligor is going to be its unstressed PD as well. So everything works out in a very nice way in a through the cycle rating system. Through the cycle rating systems, group obligors according to their unstressed PD, and the pooled PD associated with a grade is equal to that unstressed PD. And so when you work backwards and assign the pooled PD to the obligor, you get exactly the right answer. You get the unconditional, most efficient forecast of the likelihood that that obligor will default. So the Basel II approach, this two-stage approach of assigning obligors to grades and then assigning PDs to those grades, that works very well in the context of a point-in-time rating system. However, not so well in the context of a through-the-cycle rating system. Here you can do the very same calculation. You calculate the long-run default frequency without conditioning on Y, but with conditioning on the grade. You get this. This does not look like either a stressed or an unstressed PD. It's something totally different. And it doesn't really have a statistical meaning except as the default frequency associated with a grade. It doesn't really relate to the obligors assigned to that grade. And indeed, when you plug the obligor characteristics in, you get this equation, which again, if you went back a few slides, you'd see, doesn't look like either the stressed or the unstressed PD associated with an obligor in that grade. Okay. So that's very important. What that means is that if you think about Pillar 3 of Basel II, where banks are actually supposed to report their PDs to the market, and maybe people would benchmark PDs across banks, what this would tell you is that you've got to be really careful, because the interpretation of the pooled PDs generated by a through-the-cycle rating system, it doesn't really have a statistical meaning. It doesn't actually tell you anything. Well, maybe that's a bit extreme, but it doesn't tell you something specific about the probability of default of an individual obligor assigned to that grade. So I've just basically taken the results from the last two slides. Here's the pooled PD assigned from a point-in-time rating system. Here's the pooled PD that you'd assign to the very same obligor, right, with the same characteristics through the cycle rating system. The point is, because of the way Basel requires that you assign obligors to grades and then PDs to grades and then PDs to obligors, that process means that there's a role for rating system for differences in rating philosophies. And two banks with different philosophies will end up assigning different PDs to the very same obligor. And here's what it looks like in the simulation. Okay? So what I've done here is I've simply calculated the pooled PD for each grade. I've assigned that to each obligor in a grade under a through-the-cycle and a point-in-time rating system. And then what I plotted on this graph is sort of the average PD taken across all exposures in the data set. Okay? So the black line is the average unstressed PD. The blue line is the average pooled PD under a point-in-time rating system. And the point of three slides ago was that the pooled PD under a point-in-time rating system closely approximates the unstressed PD for an individual obligor. And so when you take the average across obligors, these lines lie very close together. Indeed, the only reason that they're different is because of the granularity of the rating system that I've assumed in the simulation. I've assumed 7 point-in-time grades rather than an infinite number. And notice that these PDs, the point in time pooled PD or the unstressed PD varies over the business cycle. It goes up as we move into recessions, and then it comes up, comes down as we come out of the recession. Contrast that with the average pooled PD that you get from a through the cycle rating system. Okay. Here, you have a PD that's very, very stable. Why? Because the process of calculating the pooled PD for each through the cycle grade implies that those pooled PDs have to be constant over time. They're defined to be long run averages. But of course, the through the cycle rating system also doesn't transition obligors between grades over the business cycle. As a result, when you aggregate everything up, the average pooled PD tends not to vary over the business cycle. Now, what are the implications of this fact for regulatory capital under Basel II? Well, to understand the implications, you have to understand a little bit about how the Basel II regulatory capital model was developed. It was developed basically based largely on some work by my colleague at the Fed, Michael Gordy. And Michael Gordy has a really terrific paper that I commend to anybody who is interested in this topic that sort of describes the intellectual thinking underlying the risk weight functions reported proposed in CP3. The way that thinking goes is this. Assume you have a bank whose loan portfolio is well diversified, so the idiosyncratic risk is diversified away. Assume further that there is just one single systematic risk factor that drives all correlations in risks in losses across obligors. Well, then the loss for the portfolio at the time horizon is simply equal to the conditional expected loss for each obligor, conditional on that systematic risk factor, summed up across all obligors. Okay? It's a very simple mathematical result. And what that means is that you have a very simple capital rule. And under the assumptions of this model, which granted are very stylized, the capital rule has two appealing properties. First, it will satisfy a VAR target. So the Basel Committee, for example, picked a 99.9% VAR target. Gordy's approach to calculating capital will satisfy that target. And the second really appealing thing about Gordy's rule is that it's additive. It can be executed in a decentralized way. You can calculate capital for one exposure and then another exposure and another exposure separately and then add them up and get the right capital charge for the entire portfolio. Now, the assumptions are very strong, and no one would really argue that the Basel capital rule is going to give you a 99.9% capital, VAR capital. But it provides a good integrated intellectual framework for deriving a simple additive rule that meets the 99.9% threshold. So let's apply the single risk factor approach to our model. The capital required for a particular exposure is equal to its conditional expected loss, evaluated at a tail event for the systematic risk factor. So what's its expected loss? Well, let's assume for simplicity that LGD is constant. Okay, so it's just a parameter. It's non-random. It's certainly not correlated with the systematic risk factor in the simple setting. In that case, the only unexpected component of the loss is whether there's a loss at all, so whether the obligor defaults or not. So you have the likelihood that the obligor defaults times the loss rate in the event of default. Well, what's the likelihood that the obligor defaults? That's just, of course, a PD. But this is going to be a conditional default probability. It's going to be a conditional forecast that assumes a bad draw of this systematic risk factor. Okay, the systematic risk factor is assumed to be normal, so this is the 1 minus pi quantile. And this is the capital rule you get, and of course you can analyze this capital rule. It tends to mean higher capital during recession, obviously lower capital if these two things are good. And of course, the higher your solvency threshold, the higher your capital charge. Interestingly, you can compare this equation with the equation that actually appears in CP3. This is the Basel capital rule, and you'll note that they look very similar to one another, and that's no coincidence. Actually, the implementation of this asymptotic single risk factor model was done using a very stylized Merton model that basically totally matches up with the model I proposed here. The difference, though, is that the Basel capital rule is expressed as a function of PD. Okay. Now, when we were designing this rule, we were thinking of these P's as unstressed PDs, not pooled PDs. But then, you know, when people wrote the guidance, when people wrote the implementation language, they focused on these pooled PDs, and we'll see in a second that that has some implications. So let's think about what would happen if we express the capital rule in the context of our model as a function not of obligor characteristics, as we've done at the top of this slide, but rather in terms of a PD. Well, we have a definition for what that pooled PD for a point-in-time rating system is, and you can just essentially substitute that definition in, and you can express the capital charge required to meet a 99.9% VAR target as a function of an obligor's pooled PD. And note that when you do that substitution, this exactly matches our Basel capital rule, right? All you've done is plug the pooled PD in, but because the pooled PD is actually a good reflection of the unstressed PD associated with an obligor, everything works out. That's good, because that means that if you plug the pooled PD for a point-in-time rating system into the Basel capital function, and if you believe that model, and you believe that the asset correlation parameters were set correctly, then your capital should satisfy a 99.9% VAR threshold, at least kind of in the context of the intellectual framework of the model. However, that's not the case for a point-in-time rating system. Under a point-in-time rating system, under a point-in-time rating system, you plug in the pooled PD, which no longer reflects the unstressed PD associated with the obligor, and what you end up with is a capital rule that actually has to vary over the business cycle. So you have to apply a stricter capital standard during recessions than you do during expansions. It's a kind of conservation law. We know that true capital charges have to be higher during recessions, right, to cover the additional risk associated with being in a recession. If true capital costs have to be higher during a recession, and you have a rating system and an approach to quantifying PDs that doesn't deliver PDs that vary over the business cycle, then it must be the case that your capital rule has to vary over the business cycle. But what that means is that when you plug pooled PDs under a through-the-cycle rating system into the Basel's fixed capital requirement, you actually get capital that doesn't vary over the business cycle. You get capital that because it doesn't vary over the business cycle, it won't necessarily meet that 99.9% VAR target. And again, this is best illustrated with a simulation. So the black line is the true capital requirement that you would need to meet a VAR target. The blue line is the capital requirement that you get by plugging pooled PDs into the Basel capital rule. You'll notice it tracks the black line very closely. It always lies above it, and that's because of the combination of the granularity of the rating system I've assumed and the fact that the capital function is concave. So when you're averaging across pooled PDs, it tends to raise capital. Perhaps you could say that builds in an incentive for banks to develop less granular rating systems. However, look at the red line. The red line is the capital requirement that you get from the pooled PDs constructed with through the cycle rating system, doesn't vary over time, and critically, it lies below the black line at key points at the trough of the recession, which means that if you have a bank that uses a through the cycle rating system, it's not going to hold sufficient capital to meet the Basel Committee's hypothetical 99.9% VAR target during the recession. I'm amazed at how long I can talk. Okay, I'm going to have to go quick here. What does this mean? This has some very negative implications. First, it means that Basel II will not provide a level playing field for through-the-cycle and point-in-time banks. Point-in-time banks will have volatile capital. Through-the-cycle banks will have stable capital. Second, it means that through-the-cycle banks may not meet a solvency target. How can the Basel Committee address this problem? Well, first, it could apply different capital rules, but I don't think that would actually be implementable because it would mean that regulators would have to decide whether you were applying a point in time or through the cycle rating system, and that doesn't seem reasonable. Second, it could restrict the bank's the rating philosophy. It could say that banks have to apply through this, a point in time rating system. That really goes against the idea of Basel, which is that banks should be able to use their internal systems to calculate these measures. My proposed solution would be to simply change the language, change the definition of a pooled PD. Instead of telling a bank to report the long-run average default frequency associated with a grade, instead, ask it to report what you actually want, which is the expected default probability, the expected default frequency for obligors that are currently assigned to that grade, not the obligors that were assigned at some other point in the business cycle. Okay, quickly, to validating PDs, these results that I've given you for differences between point in time and through the cycle rating systems have implications for the validation of PDs. First, if you're going to benchmark PDs across rating systems, you've got to be aware that different rating philosophies will deliver different pooled PDs. So if you plan on benchmarking PDs, you've got to either restrict peer groups to be banks with similar PDs, similar rating philosophies, or you've got to make some adjustments to the PDs that they report to reflect their differences in rating philosophies. Or, of course, you could require that they all report the same thing, which would make benchmarking a lot easier. Backtesting, the idea behind backtesting is you take the pooled PD that a bank reports and you actually calculate the default frequency over time, and you ask whether the reported PD is close to that default frequency. That makes a lot of sense. Over the short run, systematic risk is always going to drive a wedge between the forecast and the realized default frequency, so you've got to average over a number of years. But if the number of years is sufficiently long, on average, that should be a good way to validate. And I won't go through these details since we're all out of time, except that I would point out that, in general, it's going to be the case that if you think of the average default frequency calculated over a fixed number of years as an estimate of a bucket's pooled PD, that's an unbiased estimate, but it's going to have greater volatility under a through-the-cycle rating system. Why? Because the unstressed PDs associated with a through-the-cycle rating system are sensitive not only to systematic risk, the default frequencies associated with a point in time, through the cycle grade, are sensitive not only to systematic risk, but also to where we are in the business cycle, whereas the nature of the point in time rating system is to remove that cyclical component. So in conclusion, under Basel II, the rating philosophy that your bank applies really matters. Why does it matter? It matters because of the way Basel tells banks to calculate pooled PDs. It matters because it tells banks to first assign PDs to grades, then assign obligors to grades, then to assign long-run average default frequencies to those grades, and then to assign those default frequencies to the individual obligors. For regulatory capital, this means that point-in-time banks will have capital that's more cyclical. Banks will have capital that's more stable. Unfortunately, that stable capital might not be sufficient to satisfy a fixed 99.9% VAR target. In terms of validation, what this means is that regulators are going to have to control for differences in bank rating systems when benchmarking PDs, and they need to recognize that backtesting PDs under a through-the-cycle rating system is going to be not a particularly efficient estimator. I would make a simple proposal. I would say this. What I've tried to point out is that some of the language in CP3 creates some real problems for Basel II. Okay? It means that we're not necessarily going to have a level playing field across banks with different rating systems. It means that through-the-cycle banks might not be held to the same high capital standard at the trough of a recession. It creates difficulty in benchmarking PDs across banks with different rating systems, and it means that the backtesting approach is going to be less efficient for banks with through-the-cycle rating systems. I would offer that all of these problems could be dealt with a very simple change in CP3. Simply change the definition. One of the comments we got back from banks when we came forward with CP3 was that it was too prescriptive But they said more than that. They said it should focus on principles and not be so prescriptive. I think this is a perfect illustration of that. What we should tell the banks is what we actually want them to estimate, which is essentially an estimate of the unstressed PD associated with each grade, not this long-run average default frequency. So we should tell them what the target is, not what the estimator should be, because the estimator that CP3 told banks to estimate, in my opinion, is perhaps not the best one. I'll close with that.